Hi, all. Welcome to It's in the Experience, a podcast from the Association for Experiential Education, where we have thoughtful discussions with members of our community. I'm Sherry Bagley, the Executive Director of AEE and the host. I have the opportunity to speak with two of our Accreditation Council members on this episode, and I'm really excited. Kim Sackstetter is Associate Faculty in Prescott College's Adventure-Based and Nature-Based Counseling Certificate Program and co-owner of Adventure Therapist LLC, which provides training, consulting, and supervision for practitioners wanting to incorporate adventure therapy into their work. Growing up in rural Western Ohio, Kim developed both a love of the outdoors and a passion for helping youth. She took these with her to Columbus, Ohio, where she earned her master's in social work at The Ohio State University. Kim worked in the mental health field and came to realize the effectiveness of activity in engaging youth. This in turn led her to find adventure therapy. In 1999, Kim was hired to build an adventure therapy program at Camp Mary Orton. She became involved with AEE's Therapeutic Adventure Professional Group, TAPG, and was lucky to find her professional home. Kim has served AEE as the TAPG Best Practices Committee Chair, TAPG Leadership Council Secretary and Chair, and AEE Accreditation Council Member and Chair. For Kim, these experiences created a drive to increase access to training and mentorship for developing adventure programs and emerging adventure therapy professionals. Our other guest is Dr. Jose Gonzalez. Jose is Boricua, born and raised in Puerto Rico. He holds the positions of director, chair, and faculty member in experiential education at the Overlake School, an independent prep school located in Redmond, Washington. He earned his doctoral degree in education with a focus on curriculum and instruction. His career began in 1989, leading Boy Scouts on backpacking trips. In 2002, he established Aire Libre in Puerto Rico to address the demand for outdoor education on the island. Over the years, he divided his time between several geographic locations, contributing his expertise to multiple programs, and has instructed wilderness medicine, custom education programs, risk management courses, and stand-up paddling instructor certification courses. He is an avid hiker, sailor, surfer, and camper. His teaching and research interests revolve around outdoor instructors' career paths and development, as well as the involvement of people of color in the outdoor and area adventure park industries. In 1996, he attended the AE Northeast Regional Conference as a national exchange student from the University of New Hampshire and was introduced to outdoor education as an academic discipline. Currently, he serves on the AE Accreditation Council and chairs the Education Committee. Jose and Kim, wow, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Kim and Jose, we start our podcast off by asking a few icebreaker questions, just getting to know you both a little bit. And so I start off with an easy one. What is your favorite cereal?
I crack up that this is an easy one because I don't really have a favorite cereal because I really don't eat that much cereal. But if I had to pick, it would be Kashi Go Lean Crunch because I can eat it with or without milk on the go and it's fine.
Yeah, similar for me. I don't have a specific favorite cereal. The closest cereal that I had growing up was this thing called farina, right? And so farina, which is the staple ingredient in cream of wheat, but they're not the same, right? The farina is that mill grain used to make the hot and silky cereal. And then the pre-cooked cream of wheat is the one that you buy at the grocery store. So we will, my parents will make the farina and then we'll put butter on top and maybe some brown sugar.
Yeah.
And that's that was my go-to, quote-unquote, cereal, hot cereal.
Yep. Yeah. I love butter and oatmeal. Adds all that nice fat to it.
Exactly.
All right, next question. What do you always pack when you go out of town?
I always pack coffee. And Kim and I and other council member, Maury and Brent, we have enjoyed a cup of coffee of café con leche. So I pack the coffee and sometimes I bring milk too, especially evap, right? So evaporated milk in a can and I'll put it on my check bag and wherever I go, then we can have the full-on café con leche. And I really enjoy coffee, everything from picking the beans, roasting the beans, grinding the beans, and making pressed coffee. It's my go-to method, but I will drink anything, espresso, drip coffee, pour over, any way that it's made. But I think that coffee really brings us together. So I like coffee, and I'll say, just for the record, I'm not a coffee snob. I also drink instant coffee. So my better half turned me into this brand called Mount Hagen. And she said, you have to try this. And I now travel with these packages of instant coffee. I put them in many of my bags, and I bring enough for me and to share with other people, again, because coffee brings us all together. Whether it's going on a trip or going to a hotel, I always bring my coffee.
Nice. Well, yeah, a true coffee lover is not a coffee snob. Like, that's what I'm really taking away from this conversation. It's like, I love all of the coffee.
Yeah. Thank you, Kim.
I'd also say that Jose bringing coffee to the Black Mountain North Carolina AE conference, that was one of the highlights of my conference. It was like, we got to gather on these rocking chairs on the front porch in a cool morning and chat about accreditation council work. That was really wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that time that we had together.
Oh, it was fantastic. For me, what I always pack, I'm a vegetarian and have been for 30 years, and I always pack snacks and tea. I have gone through this, like, never really knowing when I'm going to get food that's going to be nutritionally sound in a good way. And so I always pack like some kind of food that will be able to sustain me. When I was first attending AEE conferences many years ago, I would go with the flow and just go to whatever restaurant people were going to as a vegetarian. And I was like, I can only eat bread and cheese so many days in a row before that just like wrecks my system. And finally have been able to have a better handle on, no, this is, I need to go someplace right now that has beans and vegetables. Let's go.
So you two are the people to find if we're out of town. You have the coffee and the snacks. So we'll be set to go.
You're well provisioned.
For sure.
That's awesome. All right. Last question, a little bit more insightful, intentional. What geographic location or place has impacted you the most?
For me, the place that has impacted me the most, it's hard to pick a most. I'm definitely torn between a couple, but would really be my time at Camp Mary Orton in Columbus. I started there when I was 25 years old, getting my master's. I started there doing my internship for my master's. It is the place that I first got to practice adventure-based work, was really first starting to do the things that I wanted to do professionally for my dream. And I was really so supported and lucky to fall into getting to work for Marcy Ryan, who is the director at the time. And yeah, I just, that place just became part of me as like I grew there. I worked there full-time for 15 years, and most of our team were there for all of that time. So I got to work with the same group of professionals for 15 years who first trained me in what I was doing and then supported the program and the progress that I was going through and eventually helped me launch into develop and who I am. So there's a piece of it that's really place-based, and every time that I go there, it's probably the place that most feels like home to me.
Nice. Thanks for sharing that.
I'll start by saying that I feel very lucky and grateful that I have lived in many places. And in those places that have made the difference or have had an impact on my life, I'll say that the reason was because of the people that I met, the friendships that I created with the people that share a common passion for the outdoors, for adventure, similar values, that kind of thing. But I'll say two places in particular. So one of them, and I know that all of that this was coming, it's Puerto Rico. So growing up in Puerto Rico. So Puerto Rico, it's my home and it's always going to be my home. In fact, when I'm at a conference right now and I run into somebody and ask me, where are you from? And I said, Puerto Rico. As soon as they pick up on my accent, they want to know. And it's always going to be. And there's some advantages to grow up in an island. So growing up in an island, the sense of community, the short distances, all these things, but Puerto Rico specifically, what the influence is on everything from the food that I eat, the culture, my traditions, the traditions that I have now with my old family. Here goes the art part of who I am right now. The other thing about Puerto Rico is that I was introduced to the outdoors through the Boy Scouts. Growing up in Puerto Rico, that was the thing in terms of outdoor education, was really the Boy Scouts. And I was very lucky that I was introduced to the Boy Scouts early on. And then I went to work for a Boy Scout camp called Oaxaca Boy Scout Reservation, and then fast forward to now. And maybe more on that later on. But in college, we had a group of friends that we will explore every single corner of the island, whether it was climbing, mountain biking, hiking, camping. And I was never the best. I had all my friends were really good climbers or mountain bikers, but I could do everything. And I was the one leading the group to the next adventure and looking in the map and going to San Juan and buying the topographic map of the area that we wanted to explore. And I still had that collection. I've been collecting maps for over 30 years now, the paper-based map, which is still like. In the second place that I'll say that had an influence on me was California. We spent about 10 years in California. Our youngest son was born in California, and especially Southern California, having that ocean-centered lifestyle that I also had in Puerto Rico growing up in the northwest side of the island, had a great impact in also thinking about the little things like enjoying the beach, going every Friday afternoon and having a picnic at the beach was very special.
Nice. Thank you, Jose. I've been lucky enough to live on several different islands in my life, and I find that there's something incredibly special about island living. No matter where the island is, it's just the sense of community on an island is huge. It's maybe because you're surrounded by water and you have to depend on each other, but the people tend to be warm and caring. You, like, you have to be careful of telling them, like, oh, I like your shirt, because they will give it to you. And I find that, like, that happens. Again, I've lived on, luckily, on several islands, but it doesn't matter where it is. It's just that sense of community and that sense of we have to share everything because we depend on each other. Yeah.
And we have common resources, right? We are in an island. I agree 100%.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you both touched on this already a little bit about how you got involved in experiential education. But if you want to expand on that a little bit more and how you found this as a career.
So I moved from a farm to Columbus and started working in a crisis shelter at 19 years old. So I actually started doing social work, kind of work, in a very different environment than I grew up in, really quickly. And in that process of doing work with clients who were coming to this crisis shelter, I'd experienced a lot of trauma. I was working with one client in particular who was coping with flashbacks and PTSD from an assault. And it was an idea of hers to do like a survivor's walk. And so we together did that walk. We scheduled it, did some fundraising for it. And through that experience of walking while trying to deal with her triggers and different things that were going on, and as we were like processing that and doing that together, it really was a very pivotal experience for her. It was very empowering and helpful for her to realize the way that an experience helped her to deal with those challenges. And that really inspired me. I was one of those folks who came to adventure therapy work, not because I was out doing a lot of different adventure activities, but because I was working with a population of kids who really benefit from adventure therapy. And so I was one of those people also who thought I invented adventure therapy. What a great idea. We need to be able to do this. And back then, which was a long time ago now, we didn't have all the resources we have today. And I looked up the only book that I could find in the Ohio State University Library that was on anything like this. And it was a wilderness therapy book by Dean Berman and Jennifer Davis Berman. And their phone number was listed in the back. And I called them. Wow. And they told me to go to AE. That's how I found AE. Yeah, which was also super pivotal, was to be able to really connect with that community and kind of build in. So that's how I got into experiential education while I was getting my graduate degree.
Thanks.
How much time do I have?
I know. It's such a hard question.
Jose and I are old. We've been around a little while.
I got involved in experiential education early on, as I said in this episode, with the Boy Scouts in Puerto Rico. And then I went to work for a Boy Scout camp in New Hampshire. And I didn't know where New Hampshire was on the map at the time. And I went to this Boy Scout camp. And there were a few people that were students at UNH. And they told me about the program. So I went back to my college in Puerto Rico. And I said, I want to go to the University of New Hampshire as an exchange student. And I did that. And then when I was in New Hampshire at UNH, they told me about this organization called Our Bound. And so I went back to Puerto Rico and started getting my skill set a little higher to be able to apply for a position with Our Bound. And it was not until 1999 that I feel that I had a shot. Like, I wasn't sure, but I wanted to give it a try. And at that point, it was the times where Our Bound will ask you to pay for the training, a nominal fee. And then they will tell you if you were hired or not. But because I was never an Our Bound student, I had another layer. I had to do a course as a student first, then do the training, and then know if they were going to hire me or not for that summer. I remember in the spring, I talked to the program director at the time, Gretchen Oster, and explained to me the process after the interview. And I decided to buy a one-way ticket to Maine and give it a shot. And I haven't looked back. So I live out of my bag for a while. And like any outdoor instructor, Our Bound has a base in the Florida Keys, or Hurricane Island Our Bound has a base in the Florida Keys. So I took turns between Maine, the Florida Keys. And then I went to grad school in Illinois. I got an assistantship to work at a outdoor education center while doing my master's. And I learned about basically the next thing for me, which was how could I be involved in higher education. And there I was lucky. Dr. Rita Yerkes was the director of the program at the time and a mentor. And I was able to complete my master's degree. And I went back to the University of New Hampshire as a residence hall director. And I was in charge of a residence, Gibbs Hall, for any UNH listeners. And I should say that when I was an exchange student, I spent my time there living in the mini dorms. They had a theme mini dorms, and one of the themes was outdoors, which was really neat because in the dorm we had snowshoes and skis and all this thing, plus 50 other students that wanted to do outdoor stuff. And it was really neat for me to, like, full circle, go back to UNH and be a professional there. And I took some classes with Dr. Deb Sugarman and other professors at UNH. And at the time, this is why I asked how much time do I have for this story. At the time, I have submitted a project that I did in grad school to start a credit-bearing Caribbean semester for Our Bound in Puerto Rico. And the director at the time, program director at the time, Gretchen, wrote back and said, hey, Jose, remember that you sent me that assignment, that project that you did in grad school? We want to do it. And for me, that was the next thing in my career path. So I went back to Puerto Rico and help establish this Caribbean semester program for Our Bound, for Hurricane and Our Bound. And we had the base in the northwest side of the island, but the students will start on a schooner trip of 21 days all the way to Grenada, the island, and then come back. And then we had one of the Our Bound pulling boats was sent to Puerto Rico, or actually two of them. And they will do sailing on the West Coast, and then they will do sea kayaking all the way down from the East Coast to the West Coast through the South End. They'll do surfing, solo, rock climbing. It was a great semester program. I'm gonna get to the end. Actually, I'll fast forward. Soon after, we moved back to New England, and I started working at Plymouth State University as the director of campus recreation. And one thing led to another that I end up having a career in outdoor education. And I'm not going to go into all the details, but here we are right now.
It's fun that both of us launched in 1999. I don't think I realized our timelines were that aligned.
I agree. I agree. So similar. Yep.
That's awesome. What's the focus of your work now?
For me, I manage the adventure therapy program that I was able to start at Camp Mary Orton. We ended up shifting it into a community mental health organization later for a lot of years. And so I was really like program management, direct service, doing that kind of work for a really long time. And then started teaching a little bit for Ohio State and had done a lot of training through our program, worked with a lot of interns, and really became excited and interested in the idea of doing more teaching and preparing the next generation of professionals and things like that. I also became involved with the Accreditation Council about 10 years ago now, and became really interested in the development aspects of programs and programming. And so I ended up really shifting gears. Nick Megley-Haberek and I launched Adventure Therapist LLC, which is a business that's set up to do training and consultation and supervision for professionals that are interested in getting into adventure therapy or bringing adventure therapy interventions into their work. So we started in 2019 thinking we're really ahead of the curve. We want to offer online options and education. We really were thinking about accessibility of training. We knew the Certified Clinical Adventure Therapist credential, the CCAT credential, was in the works and in the process of being launched. And we really wanted to make sure there were training options out there for people. And so then, of course, in 2020, the pandemic hit and so many things went virtual that all of a sudden we were like, we're behind the curve. What are we going to do? And so we really started offering trainings and launching into the world of doing training and consulting then in 2020. Which has been a great endeavor. It's been really wonderful at this point. We've gotten to run a number of in-person intensives. We have a lot of different trainings online that people can take to help underpin their training stuff. And I think my work on the Accreditation Council really motivated that because I really wanted to help people who were more solo practitioners than in the private practice realm understand what those industry expectations would still be when they're bridging this work of mental health and adventure. So Adventure Therapist LLC was really built around a lot of the ideas and accreditation and the standards that we have for programs, but to try to make them translatable to private practice folks. And then in July of 2023, I was able to start full-time at Prescott College. So at Prescott College, I have the privilege of working with Mari Lung, who's the director of the Nature-Based Counseling and Adventure-Based Counseling Certificate Program there. It's a really cool program for master's counseling students who are attending Prescott College or postgraduate counselors or therapists that are interested in incorporating adventure-based or nature-based counseling into their work. And kind of, again, just getting to do the same thing. I love getting to work with emerging professionals and help them figure out the steps of those nuts and bolts. I think back to when I made that phone call to Dean Berman, and there were just those resources weren't out there then. And so I really do have this passion and excitement around resourcing and helping folks access that information.
Kim, do you put your phone number in the back of your books now so people can call you?
That would be like a harder way to find me than on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean,
it's so wild how it's different now. But that's what I'm doing now.
Jose, you want to talk about your position now?
Yes, I'll start by saying that it's a new role for me. I saw an opportunity to impact kids at a younger age and see their evolution and grow, and I jump right in. My work now centers around providing experiential education programs to students from fifth grade all the way to high school. Here you said in the introduction, I'm the chair, I'm a faculty, and I'm also the director of the experiential education program at the Overlake School in Redmond, Washington. It's interesting because at the Overlake School, the EE program, it's both an academic program. So there are some requirements for graduation for the students. They have to go on trips with us. They have to complete number of service hours in order for them to graduate. But also, we offer trips that any student can take. The EE program ranges from exploring the wilderness through many of the outdoor trips that we offer to the partnerships that we have with nonprofit organizations through our service learning program. And also we have a whole project week portfolio of offering in the experiences ranging from building a tiny house in Seattle to rock climbing for a week in Joshua Tree National Park. Really, the mission of the experiential education program at the Overlake School is to explore the unknown, learn by doing, lead by example, and cultivate lifelong learning. So that's really what we do. Yeah. I have to say that in my free time, which is not a whole lot, but I still serve as an advisor, and this is non-paid, of the company that I helped start. I was one of the co-founders of Aire Libre. And now Dr. Luis Acevedo, also we know each other since the Boy Scouts back in that Oaxaca Boy Scout camp. It's now the owner and director of that business, and he has taken it to the next level. Now it's become a international aerial adventure parks and zip line and challenge course company that focuses on Latin America and the Caribbean, everything from designing, building, inspecting, training. Last year, we had a big gathering in Costa Rica to train Latin America professionals, mostly from the operation side. So that's a little unique as opposed to the field side. In volunteer and all those things, and I still also teach, not that often, but I still teach for NOLs in the mostly their risk management for administrator courses or wilderness medicine courses.
Awesome. You all have such great stories and such great trajectories in your work. One of the things I love about this podcast is how amazing people's paths are into experiential education and all the things that people have done in different ways they've entered it and things like that. So yeah, thanks for sharing those. That was amazing. I wanted to ask you all how you came to join AEE as a volunteer leader and be part of the Accreditation Council. What drove you to do that? Or what was your thought process behind that? Did somebody coerce you into it, or were you invited, or how did that happen?
I'll start on that one. So we talked about how I got involved with AEE to begin with. Dean said, go. And I went, showed up in the Therapeutic Adventure Professional Group, the TAPG pre-conference that they hold annually and have been for ages before the international conference. And at that time, so thinking through 1999, 2000, what was happening in the world of mental health was really the incorporation of evidence-based practices and best practices. In our field, had not really like collected into some even sort of general agreements about what that was. And so a big push of portions of the pre-conferences were really focused in on how do we develop best practices. And so in my first couple of years as I'm showing up there, at this time, there wasn't the leadership council structure that there is today for TAPG. They would collect a lot of information on flip chart paper around the room and then would look for volunteers, email out for volunteers who are willing to take a look at it. And I was very enthusiastic. I was one of those volunteers that was like, I'll help send stuff to me. And I ended up organizing this information into this crazy spreadsheet that I sent back to Keith Russell, who had helped organize some of that stuff at the time. And I think that they appreciated that component of somebody who's willing to dive in. Within those first few years of me being involved with TAPG, this whole push towards best practices was like life or death for programs at the time. So it was something we were really invested in. And at that time, there was like a single chair who was trying to coordinate these efforts to improve a whole field. And a group of people got together who had been coordinating some of these efforts and said, hey, let's create a leadership council. So we have more people in the mix here trying to help. And I was invited to be part of that first leadership council. So got to help launch that into the world. And a big part of my focus early on was helping to coordinate the best practices project at the time. And then I worked on that for about 10 years with large numbers of people. And so as soon as my time in TABG was, I did a second round on the leadership council, finished that up. And that was right when the Accreditation Council was really working on this agreement with the Outdoor Behavioral Healthcare Council about getting those programs on board. And then I was invited to apply, encouraged to apply to be on the Accreditation Council to help support the development of the therapeutic standards and things like that. So the timing worked out well to be really like good places for me to contribute over those years.
Yeah.
And oh my gosh. So that was probably when I was about 27 years old when that started.
Yeah.
I really hadn't been in the field for very long. And what's lovely about it for me is that I got such an education from volunteering and from serving. Like I definitely hands down have said and will say again that I've received more than I've given in all those times. And I've given a lot. Like it was such a wonderful, special opportunity to be able to learn from so many different experts and professionals and just great people in our fields. Very grateful for that opportunity. I encourage anyone who, even if they're like, I'm not sure if I can contribute, it's like, get in there and contribute because you'll learn a lot. It'll be great.
Yeah.
I echo what you said, Kim. I gained so much from working with all these professionals from different fields, similar fields. It's amazing how much I gain as well as give back to the industry. For me, volunteerism was role modeled by my parents. My dad was a Boy Scout leader for about 15 years. And my mother was a member and then became the president of this group in Puerto Rico called Club Cívico de Damas, so like a civic ladies group. And also she was a board member for the local hospital, a board member for the local co-op. And for me, looking at ways to be involved with AEE was a way to give back to the community, give back to the industry. I'll tell you, similar when I applied for Our Bound, that I feel that I didn't have the skill set, but I still wanted to give it a shot. And then somebody gave me an opportunity. I feel that the same thing happened with AEE. I went to a training in Georgia to be trained in accreditation programs with Dr. Jude Hirsch and Sean Tierney at the time, and who was the director of accreditation. And I gain a lot of experience and knowledge from those 3 days, and was hoping to bring that back to, at the time I was working at Plymouth State University. I was not running the experiential education program, but I was running the campus recreation, and I wanted to elevate the standard there. And then later on, I was invited to do a review. And I think that for the Accreditation Council, I still don't know how they accepted me. I feel that I was underqualified, but somehow Steve gave me a shot, right? And I'm very grateful for that. And here I am, just completed my first cycle. And so I'm starting my second cycle this year. And I'm very grateful for what Kim said early on. I learned so much. And then this sense of giving back, but also staying up to date with industry standards, best practices, and hanging out with cool people.
Yeah.
It's such a great group of people to hang out with on the Accreditation Council.
I agree. I really look forward to every single meeting and every single year when we gather in Estes Park.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the Accreditation Council? What is its work? What do you all do? What is that about?
I'll start a little bit on it. In the Accreditation Council, we focus on establishing standards and really helping to administer the accreditation program. Our goal is really around helping programs meet a standard of care for participants. When I think about the work of the Accreditation Council, what I think it really starts with, we want participants in adventure programs to have really good experiences for whatever purpose that their program is coming to accreditation for, which can be varied. There's recreation, there's education, there's therapy, whatever that is. I think we on the council really see our role as helping to ensure that our participants in any of those programs are going to have a good experience from a program that is prepared to meet their needs. And we do that through establishing standards. The Accreditation Council is made up of 14 members who are considered industry experts. We work really hard to strive to make sure we have diverse representation on the council so that we really do get a good snapshot of what's happening in the industry, what those current standards are. And then the other piece of the work of that is implementing that, is trying to write standards manuals that make sense for programs, to have a process for applying and getting this peer review through their site visit in the process of accreditation, to try to make sure that it's achievable and that it is something that can fit with what's going on for them in terms of their budget, their programming, those kinds of things. Not only are we working to set the standards, we're also really trying to implement the actual accreditation process in a way that really works for programs and is sustainable.
I'll add to that, we at the council, as Kim said, establish the standards, but also what you're talking about, the program governance, right? And also ultimately conferring that accreditation, granting the accreditation, because it's this group of volunteer and a director of accreditation that has a role as ex officio, but non-voting privileges, right? So it's really the council who says yes or no to that accreditation. The other thing that I wanted to mention is, as a council member, we're also a liaison with organizations. So we have a range between, I'll say, 5 to 8, right, Kim? in a good day.
Yes.
Thank you. Organizations that we help go through the process, and maybe we'll talk about the process in a little bit, but we are really helping them, supporting them, clarifying standards, and really being the one, not necessarily holding their hand, but really supporting them to be able to get them through the finish line. Ultimately, we want them to be accredited, right? But we have a high standard and we know that. And it's our desire and duty to help them achieve that standard.
And Jose, I think one of the great things about having a liaison for your program, because I ran a program that was accredited and I had a liaison, right? So I've seen it from many different angles, but having a liaison, you can call that person. If you have a question, if there's something happening in your program, you can call that person and ask, and they might have the answer, or they might take it back to the accreditation council and ask them. And then you have this amazing group of industry experts who can help you and support you in your programming. And so I always found that to be a huge benefit of being accredited. You have like your own panel, really, of folks who, again, want to help you and want to support you. So I think that's a huge benefit of being accredited, that accreditation liaison and the support of the council. And a shout out to Steve Pace, our accreditation director, who helps manage all of this. He is instrumental in making all this happen.
One of the things that I really love about working on the council is that it really is a group of people who is dedicated to the idea, to exploring an idea over, I have to be right, or I have to know this, or I have to know that. It really is a group of people who wants to dive into an idea and really make sure that we've thought through the different angles. And we work so well together to do that, which ultimately translates out to the programs in terms of how those standards are interpreted and what goes on from there. So it's just a great group of people to work with, because you're in a conversation and talking about this idea, and 3 or 4 different perspectives completely change the way that you think about something in the matter of 10 minutes. Like, it's a wonderful process and a group of people who are really focused on trying to really understand what is the best answer here from so many different perspectives.
Do either of you have anything to add about the relevance of the accreditation for programs? We've talked about some of the benefits and things like that, but any other things that make this accreditation for programs relevant?
I'll say the relevance for programs in programs seeking accreditation are those organizations that are aiming for the highest standard in adventure-based programming. And to me, we have never hoped that everyone gets accredited. But those who pursue the accreditation are the ones who really want to know, am I meeting that bar? Compared to my peers in this industry, where am I, right? Am I right level with them? Is that the benchmark and I'm meeting that benchmark or not? And what is it that I can do to get there? To me, that says a lot about the organization, about the quality of the program, but also about the professionalism involved in not only the people leading the organization, but also the organization overall.
One of the ideological strands that comes through the accreditation process is this value that's placed on having outside eyes look at what you're doing and being able to be informed and not getting tunnel vision about your practices. And to me, I think that the process of accreditation is really grounded in that value, that there's a piece of this where if you're like trucking along in tunnel vision, you might not be very aware of things that you can do that would be better or that would improve your program or improve your practices for your participants. And so the process really is about keeping yourself informed about what other people are doing so that you can be aware of that and learn from it. There's this huge learning process that I think is so critical to it. And that value of having outside eyes and outside perspectives that help open yourself up to blind spots.
Yes, and I hear it over and over. The value of creating the self-assessment and the value of having, as Kim said, external eyes looking at my program and looking under every single rock possible and identify what is it that I need to improve. And so those two things over and over, we keep hearing it from our programs, the value and the benefit of having those two tools and tasks and done on the program. Yep.
And just a quick overview of the process of accreditation. There's an application, and then if their application is accepted, they go through a self-assessment study, which is the SAS that Jose was just mentioning. And that is crucial. And it takes quite a bit of time and dedication from the programs. It is a lot of that looking like the program itself looks under every rock and checks out everything. And it allows an opportunity for the program to make changes right then and there. If you do a self-assessment study, you're like, oh, I didn't realize that we don't have a procedure for people driving their own cars to program with gear in it. And so you're like, oh, we need to make that happen. And so that self-assessment study is a crucial part. Once a self-assessment study happens, I don't know, Kim, if you want to tell a little bit more about what happens after that.
The next steps. Yeah. So first of all, to say, Jose was talking earlier about how the liaison supports, and that's probably one of those most critical stages, is that it didn't used to be that way. But now at the point that a program starts working on their self-assessment study, a liaison is assigned and supports them through that process of getting that self-assessment study ready to go to the next step. The next step is that our director collects a site visit team, so a team of accreditation reviewers, to go to the site and review all of those materials in the SAS. Their job is to determine if the program has met the standard. That's their whole job, is to go through each of those standards and say, is it met? Is it not met? Is it met? Is it not met? And they produce a report, a site visit report, where the number of unmets is indicated. And then the program has the opportunity to respond to that and make those changes. They have about 60 days after that site visit report comes out to respond to the different METs and unmets and things that were on there. And they work with the liaison through that process to the point that the liaison brings the accreditation before the council as a whole. And ultimately, the council as a whole makes the determination about whether those standards are met or unmet. So that's walking through the whole process.
And being an accreditation site reviewer is another great opportunity to volunteer with AE. And I find it, because I've gotten to do that piece also, but I've talked to other people who have been accreditation site reviewers. It's a great way to experience another program and learn from other programs and find even little things that you could take back to your program or your job. But it's another great volunteer opportunity here at AEE.
Agreed. I would also want to add to that, when you do a program review, just for programs thinking about this, all of our volunteers are bound to confidentiality about the work that they're doing. Yeah. So just keep that in mind for programs that might be concerned about folks coming in and looking at their program. It is really a process that's bounded around ethics of confidentiality related to work that you're doing there. So I'm like, it's a good learning experience, and the programs are also protected.
Definitely. We're winding down here. Looking 10 years into the future, what does AE accreditation look like?
I have so many ideas around
it. Okay. I knew you'd be excited about this question, Kim.
I know. I'm totally excited. I'm like, so and I'm yeah. so curious to know, because I know Jose does too. Like, both of us are those like longer term vision planners. So I'm so curious how many of ours will overlap or be similar. I'm like, should we go like one at a time to share that?
Let's do that. Let's do one at a time. Yeah.
Okay. Go first.
Yeah. I'll start by saying it's hard to predict the future. What I love, as Kim said, creating that future that doesn't exist, it's fascinating, it's thrilling, is what we do, right? In listening back to some of the episodes, Jerry, I think that you interviewed Jane Panicucci in episode 3,
mm-hmm.
and talked about back then the accreditation and how the accreditation has evolved to beyond anyone's wildest dream. And my hope is that 10 years from now, it goes beyond my wildest dream today. So I'll start with that. I would love to see the accreditation as a tool for any organization who maybe they're not ready to be accredited, but they are starting a new business, or they're starting a new program, or they need to revamp their program, and they can pick up the phone or send an email and reach out to us and say, how can you help me get to a higher standard? So I would love for the accreditation, if you will, I'm going to put my entrepreneur hat on for a little bit, but thinking about how is accreditation doesn't have just one service, if you will, which I know that we don't in theory, but from a more linear, monolithic standpoint, we do. And so how could the accreditation be something that offers services to support programs that might not be ready for a full-on accreditation, but want to achieve a higher standard and eventually become accredited? So that's one. I'll throw the rubber chicken to you now.
Yep. My next response, it's a little bit of a cheat because we actually did strategic planning during the COVID pause in accreditation work. And I think number one vision that was coming through for people was more programs accredited, like for us to have more programs coming through. And because ultimately that increases our impact, which is what is really important for us. It's like, we really want to impact the field in a positive way. And to do that, we have more programs. And to me, what accreditation would look like 10 years from now would be that we have that system for supporting programs through the process a little bit more down, that we have a system that really works to help programs go through that process. And that's part of what we've been doing a little bit of work around right now, which the first big thing that we've done towards that is we just published a new edition of the standards manuals and have really worked to not make them easier, but to make it more user-friendly in terms of the program submission, to eliminate redundancy in the standards and to do that kind of workflow tweaks that we're trying to do. To me, there's a piece of it that the process is not streamlined in the sense of quality, but is streamlined in the sense of helping programs make that jump from application to accreditation. All right, there's two. Go, Jose.
All right. The next one that I have is, how can we reach out to a more diverse group of organizations and make it an equitable process, right? So going back to 20 years ago when I started Aire Libre, I used the standards, but I knew that we didn't have the funds to bring people from United States to Puerto Rico and do a site visit and all those things, right? I think 10 years from now, we will have solutions to make a equitable process. And then we will have organizations that might be doing urban adventure-based learning, right? We will have organizations that maybe are focused on a specific group that they're serving, a specific community, right? So I see in 10 years from now, going back to what Kim was mentioning of expanding and having more organizations, I would love to see a lot of smaller organizations that are doing more dedicated impact group or focus group programming. That would be amazing.
So this is one we shared the wavelength on for sure. I was like, more diversity in terms of programs, reviewers, and space. And so that's probably the next one I'm thinking about, is that I think we'll be more international in 10 years. Mm-hmm. I think that our programs will be more internationally representative. which also would need to be supported by more international reviewers, more international focus on council membership, which I think we're also currently working on. But I think that's where we'll land.
I'll piggyback from that one, Kim. I would love to see 10 years from now that we started maybe this year, next year, a mentorship program to bring professionals that have not been tapped before for whatever reason. And now they can come in, be a mentee, and place them with a mentor that then they can become reviewers. And then the cycle keeps going on and on. So then those mentees become mentors of the new generation. So when we all retire, then we have maybe two generations of diverse reviewers, right? Going on the site visits.
I'm excited for 10 years from now. I can't wait. It's going to be amazing. Oh, friends, we have to wrap things up. We have taken up a lot of your time and we appreciate it. Jose, I know you're at the ACCT conference in Oklahoma City. Shout out to ACCT. Thanks for always partnering with us and being a great organization. We want to let you get back to that. And Kim, I know you have papers to grade and things to do. It's been a pleasure to speak with both of you. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing about AE's accreditation program. If you, our listeners, want to learn more about accreditation, you can go to our website, aee.org, where you can find a wealth of information. You can also see the calendar for our upcoming events, including our regional conferences, which are happening throughout the spring. Attend one and you might find a whole new career path, just like Jose. Listen to all of our episodes of It's in the Experience and subscribe so you don't ever miss one. Appreciate you all. Thanks so much.